Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide daily over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, business, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on homeschool when we come back. You know, when the federal income tax was launched back in 1913, the tax was levied only on the super wealthy, the richest one-half of 1% of their population with a top tax rate of only 7%. Well, today, of course, the fears of the early opponents of the tax have been more than fully realized. By the end of Herbert Hoover's term, for instance, the top tax rate had jumped to 60%. But by the time Franklin Roosevelt was done, the top tax rate was over 90%, and the tax had been dramatically expanded to seize the incomes of the middle class for the first time. Now, in 1913, the average family had to work until January the 30th, before earning enough to satisfy the tax man at all levels. This year, the average American family had to work all the way through May 12th. In order to earn enough to pay their federal, state, and local tax bills. Now, when we compare this to the plight of medieval serfs, says economist Daniel J. Mitchell, they only had to give the lord of the manor a third of their output, and they were considered slaves. Well, now, what does that make us today? Now, this income tax and Social Security tax violate three of the Ten Commandments. They violate eight statutes of the Old Covenant, including our English common law. This income tax and Social Security tax are two criminal activities. The income tax is the second plank to the Communist Manifesto, and Social Security is the eighth plank. And that's why I contend that you owe it to yourself to at least ask the question, do I really want to participate in this kind of criminal activity? If you'd like more information about tax and status, call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, while you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free. Our Tax and Status School is available on compact disc for adult home education. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, and download that free general law CD package right there. It's georgegordon.org. Click onto the archives page and then download her. All right, we're talking about homeschool, and we're going through an article here written by a young woman. I guess she was young at the time. It was about 10 years ago. See, when did I get this? Well, it's 62605, 5 years old. Her name is Diana Mertz High. It's H-S-I-E-H. It's an undergraduate paper for American Economic History. Douglas North, Washington University in St. Louis, dated 27 November 1996. So she wrote this back in 1996. It's about 15 years ago now. And I thought it was well worth reciting. I think she hit the nail on the head. It was true then, it's worse now, and it's getting worse in the future. Let's see what we can learn from this. Now, the evidence of the dysfunction and inefficiency of our present public school system is becoming crystal clear. But less clear is whether public schooling has always been this inefficient, considering the alternatives of, for example, government voucher programs or completely privatized education. This is a difficult hypothesis to test, given the limited amount of historical economic data and the vast differences between our society today and that of our society in the 18th and 19th centuries. What can, however, be examined is the assumption that universal public education was required based on the lack of education of the population at the time that public schooling was widely instituted. Now, to that end, I would like to examine the literacy rates and the other indicators of how widely the basic stock of knowledge was disseminated. But even more importantly, I want to look at the arguments of the historical promoters of public school, such as Horace Mann, to see whether public schools were actually created in response to a need to greater and more widespread education. Now, the literacy rates during the colonial period and the early history of the United States indicate that literacy was steadily growing during that time to a rather high level. Between 1650 and 1795, for example, male literacy rates are estimated to have risen from 60 to 90%. By 1840, literacy was estimated to be between 91 and 97%. And there is no evidence that there was an undersupply of schools or lack of interest in education in the United States during that period of time. The 1828 Journal of Education, for example, reports that our population of 12 million people, for the education of which we have 50 colleges, besides several times the number of well-endowed academies, leaving primary schools out of the account. For meeting the intellectual needs of this 12 million population, we have about 600 newspapers and periodical journals. When we compare that with Poland, who at the time had a population of 20 million, yet they only had 15 newspapers. The United States even fared better than England. By 1850, the United States had, or led the world with, 18% of its population enrolled in schools of some sort. In New England, the proportion was even higher. However, Liebergott estimated that even by 1860, the average child in the northern states was only spending, on average, 3 months in the classroom each year. Now, this last figure is not as important as it may seem at first, because children learn their most important skills, such as talking and, in most cases, reading, outside the classroom. It is a non sequitur to assume that the child inside the classroom is learning more than the child outside the classroom. Nevertheless, the data from these time periods is not as precise as one might like them to be. So for that reason, the motivations of the creators of public school systems might well be more fruitful. Now, in his book called Separating School and State, the author, Sheldon Richmond, examines the ideological roots of the public education system with which we're straddled and saddled today. Contrary to popular conception, public education was not created because parents were not educating their children. But rather, public education was created because parents were not educating their children as the state wanted these children to be educated. Compulsory public education was essentially designed to allow the state to take over the parenting of children so that children could be molded into obedient, docile servants to serve the interests of the state. Now, although this view sounds terribly severe, it does fit the ideology of the historical advocates of compulsory state education. In 1819, Prussia created the first system of modern compulsory education, which was designed to unify the nation and to serve the nation's need for better soldiers after their defeat by Napoleon's army. The educational system was thoroughly fascist. Franz de Hove wrote in 1917 that a fundamental feature of German education is education to and by the state, education for the state, and education by the state. The Volksschule is a direct result of a national principle aimed at national unity. The state is the supreme view in end. Richmond, page 41. And to that end, the Volksschule, which educated 90% of German children, was not designed for the purpose of intellectual development, but rather it was created for the purpose of socialization in obedience and in subordination. Now, according to John Taylor Gatto, nearly every one of the founders of American schooling had either gotten a German PhD or studied under someone who had, for example, Horace Mann and John Dewey, both, and many others wrote reports circulating the German method of education. For example, Archibald Murphy, the founder of the North Carolina public school system, wrote, quote, "In these schools, the precepts of morality and religion should be inculcated and the habits of subordination and obedience formed. Their parents know not how to instruct them. The state, in the warmth of her affection and solicitude for their welfare, must take charge of those children and place them in school where their minds can be enlightened and their hearts trained to virtue." Now, education, according to John Dewey, ought not to be designed for the intellectual development of the individual, but rather as a means of social reconstruction, which adjusted individual activity to the social consciousness. Nearly all of the founders of American public schools regarded the state's need for obedient citizens as of much greater importance than individual liberty, or independent thought, or even of independent learning of and by itself. A healthy economy, on the other hand, requires self-reliance, intellectual curiosity, and a willingness to learn, not the passive, bored, aimless, and even worse, destructive and violent children that public schools have created today. Now, much more could be said about the destructiveness of the methods by which children are taught, or the ideals, such as egalitarianism with respect to ability, that public schools promote to the detriment of most children, particularly the brightest children. But it already seems clear that public schools were created with little regard for the individual life of the child or the economy's need of an educated workforce. It is then to be wondered, and it is no wonder, that compulsory public education has failed miserably on both of these counts. And I would say to the young woman that wrote this, kudos for you, and I think you're exactly correct. The lady's name is Diana Mertz, H-S-I-E-H, kind of an odd name. I thought it was pronounced Heise or Sith. Maybe the H is silent. I don't know how you'd pronounce it. H-S-I-E-H. I'll give her credit. And we'll put this back over here. Now, who should control this public education? Or put another way, who should control education, period? Should it be the parents? Should you, the parent of the child, let's suppose that you're a Catholic communist, and the rest of us over here are Protestant capitalists? Well, we're sitting over here saying, well, since we're Protestant capitalists, and we believe we know what's better for you Catholic communists, we should control the education of your child. And we do. It is the majority of the people who, through their political representatives, create this public education system through our legislatures, and we fund them in that way. And it is our legislators that we send up here to Jefferson City or Washington, D.C. They determine what the curriculum's going to be, what the modality of education is going to be. Now, I'm of the opinion that Mormon people in Utah should educate their children in their own home schools to the standards that they desire their children to achieve. I know it isn't the socialist method, but you know, those people out there, those are their children, and so why should I dictate to them through my political persuasions how they should educate their child? And I would say the same thing for all of you Catholics up there in Massachusetts. If you want to educate your children to be Catholic communists, that's your business in life, and I think you should have the right to do that. Now, conversely, I think that I should have the right to educate my children the way I want them educated. I mean, I gave you Catholics and Mormons leave to educate your kids your way. But see, the system doesn't work that way. You Catholic communists up there cannot let me educate my children to my standards. And you Mormons can't allow me to do that either. So what all of us have done, because we're intolerant and unable to let the Catholic communists and the Mormons educate their children their way, we then have to subscribe to this political program that the state will make that determination. Now, here's the problem with having the state do it. The state now is controlled by occultists. It's controlled by the moneyed powers and the powers behind the scenes. And so they're going to dictate to you Catholic communists and you Mormons and me, the Hebrews out here, how we're going to educate our children. So they teach them evolution. And you Catholics up there don't want that. And you Mormons don't want that, and I don't want that, but by God, that's what we're going to get, because we can't allow each group, each individual family, to educate their children to their own standards. We cannot allow that level of freedom in America, or Canada, or Australia. We can't, we haven't, we're not, and we're not going to. Ah, but wait a minute. We do have a couple of outs here. And homeschool is one of those outs. Now, you take a look in Anglo-Saxon administration, you Australians and New Zealanders down there, you have a provision down there in your constitution for educating your children at home. So do you Canadians. So do we here in America. Some of them are more stringent than others. Pennsylvania, they're god-awful nasty. Alaska is really good. Missouri's pretty good. They don't dictate to us how to educate our children. They simply say, we want to make sure that your children are at least up to public school standards. Oh my God. The public school standards are so low that if you couldn't educate your child to at least the public school standards in your home school, you shouldn't be homeschooling. You should send them to public school. I wouldn't deny it. I mean, hell, if you're that poor, you know, well then, you know, public school, which is at the bottom of the heap, you know, at least educate them to the public school standard. Now remember, public schools, on average, score at the 50th percentile. Write this down, Mary. Tell Bob when he comes home tonight. Public school, on average, nationwide, coast to coast, border to border, add in Washington, D.C., and then New Orleans, the two poorest school districts in the country, the dumbest, poorest, and then put in the best and the most affluent, you know, the ones in Arlington, Virginia, and San Leandro, California. They're the best. All right, add those in. 50, that's where they average. Now, send your kid to Washington, D.C. or New Orleans or any inner-city public school, and on average, they'll score at the 28th percentile. 28! Got that? Not even 50. 28. Now, go send your kid to any average parochial school, and they'll score at the 80th percentile. And if you homeschool them, they'll score at the 86th percentile. Here in Missouri, they just require that they score at least to the state standards, which are the lowest standards in America. If they can make the lowest standards in America, that's okay by us. Now, when my daughter scored at the high school level, you know, plus, if you were to compare my daughter to my grandmother, for instance, she would have been deficient because my grandmother at the eighth grade had a better education than you high school graduates do today. And I'm not sure that my daughter at her graduation level could have scored at the eighth grade level of 1895. She might have. She might have. But I kind of doubt it. By today's standards, she's real smart. But by, you know, 1900 standards, I'd say she's probably average. You know, just an average run-of-the-mill kid. But now, who should control education? Now, listen to this. A terrible tension is developing in this country as to who will control education. The dilemma provokes all manner of scare words, like censorship, pornography, Marxism. Well, antagonists are manning the battlements. First of all, let's picture the father and mother who deplore the anti-traditional values and the vulgarity that they believe their 14-year-old daughter is being subjected to and taught at their local public school. Then picture the crosstown couple up in arms against challenges like obscene or anti-American regarding their 14-year-old son's textbooks and assigned reading material. The first couple want their child taught about the country's religious heritage, about the biblical account of creation, as well as about the theory of evolution, about literature that does not depend upon explicit discussion of sex and violence or upon the use of dirty language. Now, the second couple want their child to be free to read anything, to grapple at an early age with the realities of life, to make his own judgments about religion, lifestyle, and history. Now, complicating this standoff is the role of the professional educator. And a majority of those siding with the second couple, or indeed maybe even leading the second couple, prefer to break this anachronistic shackles and to make the schools a marketplace of ideas. They want the couple with traditional values to let the professionals run the schools and educate the children. Professional educators and the second couple, those emphasizing the freedom to do your own thing, have held a decided edge in the American educational system for years. And I'm not sure if their edge is the result of numbers or decibels. But I tend to think it's the latter. I think they yell a lot louder. Now, although this group has been forceful, hardworking, and outspoken, I'm not sure that it would carry the day in a public vote about who should be educating children. And I'm convinced that parents are, beyond a challenge, ultimately responsible for educating their children. They hold final authority, and in most cases, obviously, parents delegate a good deal of the teaching to others, usually to school systems, and that probably works, but not if they delegate total responsibility and authority as well. And that's what we Americans have now done. We are trapped in our terrible dilemma. Through parental abdication, the professionals decide what our children are to read and what they are to learn, and then they undertake the teaching, and usually following a model that says there are no absolute values, and even if there were, that classrooms are to be value neutral. In some states, aroused parents are beginning to reassert what they perceive to be their God-given right to guide their children's education, and especially in textbook and curriculum content. Naturally, they're running into vocal opposition. We hear talk of censorship, redneck, Nazi, or worse. Now, I want to make it clear, and I'm troubled by outright censorship. I fully realize that good literature often involves some sex, some violence, and perhaps even some foul language. Good writing insists upon conflict and confrontation as its backbone. But it does not insist upon incessant obscenity and bad taste. And although literature must often delve into controversial philosophies and social theories, it should be truthful, it should be honest, and it should be just. Therefore, parents need to be thoughtful and discreet in their attempts to influence what's read in the public schools. Similarly, educators need to be judicious and sensitive in recommending reading matter for their classes. The two groups can work together, if only they'll stop shouting long enough to hear the voice of goodness and righteousness. Well, Dr. Richard Baer of Cornell University, a longtime student of ethics and education, take issue with those who argue that public schools are a genuine marketplace of ideas. America's government monopoly school system cannot rightly be described as a marketplace of ideas, as is frequently done in public school censorship disputes. He says in an illuminating booklet called Censorship in the Public Schools, "The actual situation in public schools, as Dr. Baer explains, is that all textbooks, all library books, all curricula, all films, and all other educational materials are pre-selected by teachers, state agencies, and schools of education. There is, in a real sense, they are all totally censored. There are no Bibles, there is no prayer, and there is no other ideas allowed in the public school system. It has nothing to do with being a marketplace for ideas. It is a closed ideological market for the educated elite only, and they decide what will be allowed in and what will be thrown out." Now, equally intriguing is this criticism of opening the floodgate of ideas to all youngsters. The position that the child should be exposed to a multiplicity of values, he says, presupposes that the state has the right to violate the parents' wishes for the child's moral and religious development. Well, I believe that if we want to work at it, we can salvage the educational system. And I do believe that most parties want the best for their children. They need to recognize principles established early in our history that say to parents in a number of ways, train up a child in the way he should go. Even when he is old, he will not depart from it. Proverbs 22, verse 6. Now, that was an article published in the Saturday Evening Post, Speaking Out, Who Should Control Education, by Bob Schlosser. Well, Bob, those are wonderful metaphors. I love it. Unfortunately, you've got your head up your hind end. It isn't going to work. It hasn't worked in the past. It isn't working now. And it isn't likely to work in the future. And that's because the people who are in control of education are amoral at best and immoral at worst. The educational system isn't in its present state of decline accidentally or because of some neglect. It's in a state of decline on purpose. It was created that way. The immorality in the public school isn't an accident, it's a design. All right, now here's how we correct that. Let's suppose you're a Mormon and you're living out in Salt Lake City, and you don't like the public school. You don't like the way your daughter's moral training and the educational system at hand is being conducted. Well, why don't you take charge of your child's education and do it at home, which is what God told you to do in the first place? Now, your Creator created you, and He said, "Now, I want you to educate your child. I require it." Why don't you educate your child in the Ten Commandments? I know that's a wild new concept, but, you know, give it a try. And the morality of the Mormons cannot possibly be any worse than the amoral education in the public school. And that's amoral at best. It's immoral at worst. I mean, if it's amoral, that's not good, but, you know, and that's the best that they have to offer. And, you know, if you're a Catholic communist up in Massachusetts, that's fine. Why don't you educate your child to the morality of the Catholic Church? I mean, it isn't the same morality that a lot of the rest of us would like to see imposed upon you, because we all know what's better for you Catholics than you do. But in the interests of intelligence here, if I run around telling you Catholics how to educate your kid, aren't you going to turn around and tell me how to educate mine? Why don't we try something wild, new, and off the wall? Why don't we allow people to educate their children to their standards? I know it's wild, but think about it. Hey, we're at the halfway point here, so let me remind you that you are listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, and that we are sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, around the world, in more than 120 countries daily, over the Internet and radio. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then would you please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Why don't you be sure to order yours by simply calling and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. It's free, didn't cost you anything, place to start. That number again, 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org. Go to the archives page. When you get there, download it right there. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. And the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Now, the present history of the public school system traces back to the Scopes Monkey Trial in 1925. You see, back in those days, the Christian evangelistic types, you know, the evangelicals, the hardcore Southern Baptists were in control of the school systems. And they taught prayer in public school, and then they taught the Ten Commandments, and they taught various doctrines and things. And this really bummed out evolutionists and atheists and people that weren't religious. And it probably bummed out a few people, you know, like Jews sending their kids to public school, and they probably got bummed out and said, I don't like this Christian crap, and so on. But when we had this Christian school system, when we taught Christianity, we taught morals and morality and so on in our public schools, our children could read by third grade. I went to public school. I can assure you that by the end of the third grade, I could read. And I could tell you all the states and all their capitals by fifth grade. There were standards. And Johnny could read. And these standards that the president and the secretary of education were telling you that we want to establish back in 1999. Hell, we already had that when I was a kid in school. But it was well underway. The change had been well underway since the turn of the century. We wanted to change our public school system, and we did. So whether it's neglect on your part, you voted for the wrong people, or you know, come up with whatever excuse you want. The reality of life is that this is where we're at today. Now, what are you going to do tomorrow to change it and fix it? And the answer is just as simple as a phone call or a Google search, or a phone call to the local Baptist or Catholic school, or to a source for a homeschooling program. You just do it yourself. You know, if you were dissatisfied with the plumber that came in and charged you $50 for cleaning out a drain, you know, if you go buy yourself a snake down at the local hardware store, you could probably clear that drain out next time by yourself and do it, you know, for pennies on the dollar. And a lot of us do that. We get tired of these guys sticking it to us, and so we go down to Home Depot and we get a book and we come home and we fix it ourselves. Don't we? Okay, well, your education system's broke. And you can't expect the plumber to reform himself. You know, the plumber, he's been screwing you, bluing you, and tattooing you, and he's not going to change oven by himself. He might change after he wakes up one day and he's lost half of his business. You know, he might change his tune. But the NEA and the school authorities today, they're not going to change jack diddly squat, and they're going to scream like gut-shot banshees at any changes that you might suggest. I wouldn't waste my time going down to the local Ludi school board and voicing my opposition to the textbooks that they're using there. What I would do is go over to my local Catholic school and say, "What is it that you're teaching over here?" And I'd listen to their sales pitch, and I might even give them a try. Local Baptists. There's a local parochial school up here in Ava. Now I'm out here in the boondocks. I don't think we're going to find any Catholic or Baptist school, but there is a school up here in Ava, private school, 30 miles away, 40 for me. But here's the moral to the story. If I wanted to, I could make that change. And while I might not be able to afford the extra $2,500, $3,000, you know, to send my child to a parochial school, I think I could scratch out $500. Let me show you how you do that. Cigarettes right now, you know, cigarettes are $3.50 a pack. You're smoking a pack a day. That's $3.65. You know, you're smoking a pack a day. That includes Saturdays and Sundays, doesn't it, Bob? Okay. All right, 365 days times $3 a pack. Let's go down to the Indian reservation and buy them cheap. That's $1,095. That'll educate two kids right there. Well, I don't deny it. You're going to have to give up smoking. I mean, you know, you're going to have to sacrifice for your children. Let me ask you this. Are your two children worth $1,000? They either are or they aren't. Now, forget about any tax breaks, because you're gonna pay taxes anyway. The property taxes on your house are not going to go down by $1,000 a year because you're going to educate them in public school. That isn't going to happen. But, for that $1,000, number one, your health will be better because you quit smoking. Number two, your children are going to get a 60% better education. And if you're sitting there saying, yeah, but I'm dumb. No. No, you're not going to educate them out of any knowledge that you have. You're going to educate your children based upon the knowledge in the curricula that you're going to buy from the Catholics or buy from the Baptists or Lutherans or whatever group you want to buy it from. All of them, put them out there. They're all out there. Just get homeschool, plug it into Google, start doing a little research over there, or Yahoo or somebody, or Bing, or whatever your favorite is. Start looking it up. You're going to find all kinds of schools out there. Ask them for a catalog. Tell them to send it to you. What are you charging? The average is $546. It's the number I saw here the other day, last time I saw a number. And maybe it's going to cost you $600 or $700. Well, okay. Maybe you got to buy a computer for your kid. Well, so, go down and buy him one. Now, you people all have money for the essentials of life. And those are alcohol, tobacco, firearms, gasoline, and coffee. And there isn't a one of you out there that's going to do without those five essentials of life. Remember that. If you gave up one of those essentials of life, you probably would have enough money left over to educate your kid. Some people who are really innovative, like the one I read to you yesterday, created their own curriculum. Now remember that not very many, there are some homeschool children whose parents are college educated and who may even have a teaching credential. And I think the number I saw was around 6%. You take all these homeschool kids, you got 4 million of them. Let's just take a number here, 4 million. And times 0.06, I think is the number I saw. 240,000 of those children actually have college-educated parents with a teaching credential. About 250,000 out of 4 million have those essentials, as the school people would like to have you believe that those are essentials. Now, keep this in mind. As bad as our public school system is, every one of those teachers in that system have a college education and a teaching credential. And their students average the 50th percentile. And the 94% who do not have a college education, do not have a teaching credential, their children average the 86th percentile. Now, I'll just leave it to you to figure that out. Huh? Now, let's take a look at the history of homeschooling. How's that? Homeschooling is a radical idea to most people. After all, just how is a child supposed to learn what they need to know to get into college or get a good job if they aren't learning all of those important things in the public school? How are they going to grow into responsible citizens without 180 days or more for 16 years of compulsory public and or private education? And that time doesn't count preschool readiness programs and after-school enrichment programs. Schooling is so complicated and learning so difficult that a scientific clinical approach to education seems to be what the best and wisest parent would want for their children. But you know, something is wrong with these modern-day assumptions, which is why alternatives to public and private schooling are thriving. Now, homeschooling is radical. In the root sense of the word, in Latin, radicus means root, compulsory schooling, forced attendance. And now, in the 21st century, compulsory education, forced learning, are very recent petals and offshoots of the root that mankind has historically nurtured its young into responsible adults and active citizens. Family, community, religious institutions, and work were all integrated into the daily lives and upbringing of children. Sometimes there were professional or informal tutors available that some families hired or shared to instruct children at various times for short periods during their lives. Other families used daily chores, apprenticeships, and internships to educate their children. Continuing in these traditions, similar arrangements are made by homeschoolers today. The concept of universal compulsory schooling is a very recent idea, one that's not even 200 years old yet. And yet we act as if it's as ancient, surefire way to make sure our children learn something, as is God and the Bible and creation. Many teachers, parents, and students have written in many eloquent books and essays about how our children do indeed learn something during their schooling years, but often it's in a reaction against or in spite of or not related at all to the fixed curriculum that they're being exposed to in daily doses every day in the public school. Now, America's founders did debate a bit as to whether or not they should force children to attend schools, and they decided to leave such decisions to individual families and local and state governments. The words education and school appear in none of our founding documents, such as the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, or the Bill of Rights. Some of our most famous inventors, writers, and politicians were self-taught, self-educated, learning through mentoring or apprenticeships, conversation and reading, and this route to adulthood continues today. But by 1850, when Massachusetts became the first state to institute a compulsory schooling law, attitudes towards children and their place in society began to change. Children are forced to attend schools for many reasons, but in this early period it was largely to keep them out of the workforce and to teach them to become good citizens. Nonetheless, one can easily find examples not just of the wealthy people, but of the common people opting out of mass schooling in order to teach their children in home schools at home. Parents in the 19th century used itinerant teachers and books such as Samuel Griswold's Fireside Education, published in 1828, and Burton and Warren's Helps to Education in the Homes of Our Countries, published in 1863, to help them as they raised their children in their homes and communities. As more laws made public schooling more encompassing of children's time, some teachers and parents questioned the growing consensus that more and more school was better for children than time spent growing up in other settings. No one wanted to send children back to work in the coal mines, but some people felt that school might not be the best place for children to learn. Tufts University professor A.A. Burrell wrote in the introduction to his book called The School in Your Home, published by Moffett Yard in 1912, that American mass education has been a failure over the past 25 years, and that people from day laborers to university professors have written to him about it. Burrell claims he holds hundreds of letters from parents asking him how they can teach their own children at home because of their dissatisfaction with public schooling at the turn of the century. Now, here's a guy that wrote a book back in 1912, and he says, hey, people were dissatisfied with the public school system at the turn of the century. Public schooling became the norm in Massachusetts in 1838. They're the guys that started it. By 1850, they made it compulsory. California did the same thing in 1886. By about the turn of the century, or 1910 or 20, nearly every state in the Union had compulsory education laws on the books. Now, it could well be that reading, writing, and arithmetic are important, and maybe there were some families out there that weren't doing the job. But the literacy rate, remember, in 1828, as we heard yesterday, was 90% plus. And today, the literacy rate is about 50% plus. So, the nation is less literate today than it was in 1828 before we had any public schools. So, any argument that you're going to come up with over here, you know, now people today will say, oh, no, that can't be true. Hey, listen, I'm just taking the stuff off the internet that I get here. I'm just reciting here from the book called The School in Your Home, Moffett Yard, 1912. The Homes of Our Country is 1863, and Fireside Education, 1828, you know, I'm just telling you where the bear does it. Now, I've mentioned this in times past. Not everything that we know or think that we know is necessarily true. I mean, I went to public school, and they told me without public school, we'd all be dunces. I believed it at the time. Now, I've done a little research into this concept of school, public school, parochial school, and so on. And I've come to the conclusion now, this is my conclusion, public school is the poorest means of education. It's not the only. It's not even necessarily wicked, evil, or bad. I wouldn't tell you not to send your kid to public school. I would even go so far as to concede that public school in Washington, D.C. and New Orleans would be better than nothing. Hell, even God himself requires that you educate your child. Now, of course, God's a little more picky. He says, I want you to educate your child to my standards. Here's what I want you to educate him in. But, you know, Even God himself requires compulsory education. He requires, as a matter of law, that you educate your child. Well, the state of Massachusetts came along and said, well, we require, as a matter of law, that you educate your child. Well, okay. I guess the question is, well, what are you going to educate your child to? Occult? Witchcraft? You want to educate them to amorality or immorality? And then, of course, all of us have our own concepts of morality. As I mentioned before, Mormons have a different concept of morality and religion than do the Catholics and Baptists and Buddhists. But, again, I brought this to your attention. I said, well, why don't we let the Buddhists educate their children to their corrupt pagan ideology? Which is what you believe it is. I mean, if you're not a Buddhist, it's a corrupt pagan ideology. And then if you're any other religion than Mormon, you know, you know, you'd say, well, those Mormons are corrupt pagan ideologists. But again, you know, once we give over this power to educate all children by law in the public schools, then you have abdicated any control that you might have over that child's education. I mean, you gave it to somebody else. And I'm suggesting that you take that back. It's lawful and legal here in the United States. In fact, I'll bet you that it's lawful and legal in most countries around the world. You could do that if you put your mind to it. And I think in the final analysis that we'll all be better off. If the Mormons are educating their children to be a little smarter, 60% smarter, you know, one of the Mormon kids might invent something out there that you and I might want to buy later on that might benefit us. Kind of like Thomas Edison. Did you know Thomas Edison? Thomas Edison was homeschooled, self-educated, didn't go to public school. Henry Ford only went to the sixth grade. And that probably held him back. Imagine what he could have been if he hadn't have been brainwashed by the public school system. So I just thought I'd throw that out there for your consideration. Now, a fascinating example of early urban homeschooling comes from a mother in New York City, Rita Sherman is her name. Her book, written anonymously, A Mother's Letter to a Schoolmaster, anticipates many of our 21st century reasons for homeschooling, such as her deep concern that her son's individual learning style, creativity, and intellect would be damaged by standardized, one-size-fits-all education. Her letters show her rationale for homeschooling, vivid descriptions of the success that she is having with her son as she lives and learns with him, and the schoolmaster's reluctant approval for her to do so. Now, Mrs. Sherman can tend to over-inflame speech, but she nonetheless makes many interesting social and educational arguments against compulsory schooling, but in support of public education, for example, work, study, facilities open to all ages. Now, from the 20s through the 70s, homeschooling was a relatively underground, usually rural phenomenon. Homeschooling occasionally popped up as a topic of conversation, but as a two-part series in the Atlantic Monthly in the late 1940s put it, that eventually became a book, The Home Education of a Boy by William Barrett, publisher unknown, published in 1950. But homeschooling remained at best a fringe topic during the period of the 30s, 40s, and 50s. But all that changed in 1970 when Ivan Illich published Deschooling Society, New York, Harper and Row, 1970, reissued in London, England by Boyers in 2001. This short book called not for the abolition of schools, but for an abolition of compulsory attendance laws. Illich's ideas and language can be stunning, and Deschooling Society spurred people into public education and public debate, Education Without Schools by Peter Buckman, published by Condor, 1973, and Private Action, No More Public School, Harold Bennett, Random House, 1972, For a Man Destined for Homeschooling Fame, John Holt. These ideas spurred him to question his career as a popular education reformer. Now, there are a number of people that have been in this same boat. These are people just like you and me and everybody else. We take a look at this and we say, oh my God, am I the first guy to ever think this up? No. Here's just a whole host and plethora, about six or eight books written on the subject of homeschooling, written back in the 70s and 80s, published. They're out there in the marketplace. Just plug in homeschool and you'll get a number of these books and topics. Then why don't you take one of these books and read it? These guys are exposing the public school system for the farce that it is. They're just telling you, hey, this is a bunch of crap. Now, here's the way I propose that we solve the problem. And some of these people have different ideas. And if you want to send your kid to public school, I don't want to take public school away from people that want public school. But I don't want to take home education away from people that want something better than public school for their children. And most people cannot afford to send children to parochial school. It is pricey. You're already paying the taxes. But bear in mind, homeschool is $546 a year on average. That's less than a pack of cigarettes a day, boys and girls. I'm out of time again. I got to leave it right there. We'll take it up tomorrow, same time, same station. But let me remind you that you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, and that we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated every week. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. There's the signal, says my time's up, I gotta leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.